Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Maaco comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Whatever it is, Maaco has you covered. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. Get started. Visit your local Maaco today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Let's be real. Life happens. Kids spill. Pets shed. And accidents are inevitable. Find a sofa that can keep up at washablesofas.com. Starting at just $699, our sofas are fully machine washable inside and out, so you can say goodbye to stains and hello to worry-free living. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, they're kid-proof, pet-friendly, and built for everyday life. Plus, changeable fabric covers let you refresh your sofa whenever you want. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa anytime to fit your space, whether it's a growing family room or a cozy apartment. Plus, they're earth-friendly and trusted by over 200,000 happy customers. It's time to upgrade to a stress-free, mess-proof sofa. Visit washablesofas.com today and save. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
That it is. Welcome to our sixth segment of coverage for you today in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Let's go to the courtroom.
They bring the jury. Sir, cross-examination.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
Just want to see if we can agree on one thing, and that is you're not here to tell this jury that any of the weapons in this room were used, in your opinion, to murder Maggie or Paul, correct?
Based on my examination of the evidence, I was able to identify that there were matching mechanism marks in items around, as mentioned, the body of Maggie Murdaugh and other areas of the property. And in regards to the two shot shells in comparison with those shotguns, items 9 and 10 were inconclusive with the item 22 shotgun.
So that means you cannot, and you did not, and you are not offering an opinion that item 22 shotgun was used to murder Paul Murdaugh, correct?
My result was inconclusive. And what that ultimately means is I'm not able to determine that. It's a possibility that it could have been fired by that shotgun, and it also could have been another firearm with similar characteristics.
Meaning it's just equally possible it wasn't that gun.
That's possible.
And this 300 blackout. We know a 300 blackout was used to murder Maggie Murdaugh, correct?
Based on the evidence that I received, I did have several projectiles that were 300 blackout caliber that were most consistent with that, as well as several cartridge cases that were head stamped that caliber.
And you're not here to tell this jury, in your opinion, that this 300 blackouts laying on the floor here was used to murder Maggie Murdaugh, correct?
The results of the comparisons of those cartridge cases, items 2 through 7, with test fires from that item 33 rifle were also inconclusive, meaning I was unable to determine if those cartridge cases were fired by item 33 or they've been fired by another firearm.
Well, how many how many cartridges were found at the murder scene of 300 blackouts? Do you remember?
Based on my understanding of the crime scene, I believe I was only submitted items 2 through 7. So that would be 6 fired 300 blackout caliber cartridge cases. And again, I was not at the scene to recover those. That's just what was submitted to me, and based on my understanding of the evidence.
Okay. I'm gonna stay on the 300 blackout for a moment, and I'm gonna show you what we marked as Defendant's Exhibit 69.
Previous comment on that.
Excuse me?
Just what I previously talked
about. Yeah. And you have your file there, but take a look at Defendant 69 and see, tell us if you recognize that document as coming from your firearms file report, excuse me, extended report.
Yes, sir. This state's exhibit.
Defendant's exhibit.
Excuse me. Yes, sir. Defendant's exhibit 69 does appear to be a copy of 2 pages from my case file.
Thank you. Your Honor, we would move Defendant's exhibit 69 in the evidence, I believe, without objection.
Without objection.
It's admitted.
This is page number 67 and 68. We're going to pull it up on the screen, and while we're doing that, Agent Greer, is this your worksheet for the 300 blackout that's here in the courtroom and sled item 33, which bears state's exhibit number 88?
Yes, sir. That would be a copy of my worksheet for sled item 33.
Okay. And this is the item that you're not prepared to tell the jury here that, in your opinion, was not used to murder Maggie Murdaugh.
Based on my examination of the cartridge cases, or several of those cartridge cases that were recovered from all the locations, the results of those comparisons were inconclusive. I'm unable to determine if they were fired by that firearm or by another firearm or firearms with those similar characteristics.
But you did test fire this item 33, correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
And on the second page of exhibit 69, Doug, if you'll pull up the description of what happened, and if you'll tell the jury what problems you encountered when you test fired item 33, which is state's exhibit 88.
Yes, sir. During the test firing, I loaded the magazine with cartridges. That was sled item 34. And I inserted that into the magazine well of the sled item 33, the rifle. I chambered the first available cartridge into the firearm and fired it. That went as expected. The cartridge was fired. It extracted and ejected from that firearm properly. However, as that bolt was going back forward, I would have expected it to pick up the next available cartridge from the magazine. However, it didn't. and I had to manually cycle that bolt again to load the next available cartridge from the magazine. That issue did not prevent me from test firing it, and I was able to collect those test specimens that I needed, and no further analysis to determine the cause of that was conducted.
So when you say you had to manually, it says as the firearm cycled, the next available cartridge in the magazine failed to feed in the chamber. So then you had to manually do it. How do you manually do it?
Yes, sir. On the top of the firearm, there's a charging handle. I had to pull back on that charging handle, which in turn pulls that bolt backwards. And when I did that and released it, it was able to then go forward on its own and pick up the next cartridge from that magazine that was inserted into the firearm.
Okay. And you had to do that every time you fired Exhibit 88, is that correct?
Yes, sir, I believe so. During my test firing, I did have that phenomenon occur.
So is it fair to say Exhibit 88, item 33, was malfunctioning when you tested it?
It did not work as I expected it to. I would have expected it to fire and load that next cartridge as it should. However, when we're test firing these firearms, we're holding them in different weights because we're test firing them in a bullet recovery tank, which at the time was a vertical tank filled with water. So I had to hold it in kind of a strange position. But through all my test firing, I did have this situation occur. But again, no other testing to determine why that was happening was conducted, and I was able to test fire that gun and collect those test specimens.
And is it fair to say you were not able to rapid fire, pull the trigger, and shoot bullets in immediate succession?
During my testing, I had to manually load that next cartridge in. So it just took the amount of time that it would take me to do that step, if you will. Instead of the firearm performing that function for me, I had to do it. And that's what I did in this case.
Okay. And then, all right. Were you able to get the projectile out of the water tank and compare it to the two projectiles found at the murder scene, I believe. I don't know if it's item 8 or, as part of your analysis, did you compare projectiles from item 33 to the projectiles found at the scene?
Yes, sir, that is correct. I did collect those test-fired bullets from our water tank, and I did compare that where appropriate with the fired projectiles that were submitted.
And did you reach any conclusions based upon that projectile comparison?
Yes, sir, I did.
And what were those conclusions?
Based on the observable physical characteristics of items 8 and 12, those are sled items 8 and 12, I determined those to be most consistent with 300 blackout caliber. Item 8 may be suitable for identification with other evidence, and item 12 sustained damage, and it was unsuitable for identification with other evidence. That means that due to the damage that it had sustained, there were no identifying features that I saw under the microscope that I would use for identification purposes. I also received several other projectiles and fragments that I compared to the item 33 rifle. Due to damage in their size, the calibers items 11, 66, and 137 could not be determined. They were just too small for me to make any determination about their caliber. Due to damage and the limited marks of value that I saw on item 11, specifically the fired bullet jacket fragment and the item 66 fired bullet jacket fragments, I was concluded that those may or may not be suitable for identification and compared those later on to the rifle. Based on that no marks of value that were displayed on the item 11 bullet jacket fragments, item 11 piece of lead and item 66 pieces of lead, I determined those were unsuitable. So again, due to there being no marks of value for me to compare, I was unable to compare those with those test bullets. Item 137 bore some type of striated marking. However, I was unable to determine the origin of those marks and use those for an identification purposes. And it was determined that it was also unsuitable. Lastly, the three items that I did compare with those test specimens that fired from those rifle, which were item 8, the item 11 fired bullet jacket fragment, and the item 66 fired bullet jacket fragments, the results of those comparisons were also inconclusive with each other and with those test specimens, and that was just due to damage and just insufficient markings for us to base our opinion on. It could not be determined whether those items were fired by item 33 or by another firearm or firearms with similar characteristics.
So exhibit 250 is the projectile that was found by marker 8, I believe, is confirmed that form of conclusion.
Yes, sir, that is correct. State's exhibit 250 was sled item 8, near tire impression at marker 8. That's correct.
And I believe you, just as you're reading from your report, told the jury that you couldn't make any conclusions about the projectile seized at the scene from the projectiles fired in a water tank from this 300 blackout laying on the floor in here. Is that right?
That's correct. The results of those comparisons were inconclusive, so I'm unable to determine if item 8 was fired by the rifle or by another firearm with similar rifling characteristics.
Well, aren't the rifling marks on a projectile as it goes through the barrel more reliable when making firearm identifications than most any other tool marks that you rely upon?
I wouldn't say they're more reliable. We do rely on the rifling in that barrel to mark those projectiles, and that's what gives those markings puts those markings on those bullets, so we're able to look at them and do a firearms identification examination on them. Tools, firearms, all mark evidence. Again, I was unable to do that in this case, and my results were inconclusive. I mean, that's due to the damage that these may have sustained and to just insufficient markings that were on the bullet when I looked at it. There was not enough of those markings on there for me to determine if they were fired by item 33.
But the item 8, exhibit 250 there, do you recall whether there was human organic matter on that projectile when it was recovered?
Let me refer to my notes. I don't have documented in my notes that there was any foreign material or trace on it as I received it.
But we know that that projectile was recovered at the murder scene at marker 8. Is that right? Near the tire.
Yes, sir. Near the tire impression at marker 8. That's correct.
And you made comparisons of shell cartridges, the back end of the full bullet that were collected at the shooting house on the property at Moselle. Did you not? I don't have the numbers, but we went through them a moment ago. You did. Let me ask you to take a look at the projectiles that were found. I believe they're items, they are items 108 through 125. I'm not sure what their state exhibit numbers are, but if you look at 108 through 125 in your report, those are spent 300 blackout caliber cartridge cases.
Sled items 108 through 125 was determined all to be fired 300 blackout caliber cartridge cases.
And in your report, it references left of shooting chair near field, right front corner, et cetera. Maybe you don't know, but Or are you aware those were collected at a gun house at a firing range on the property?
Yes, sir. And I'm going to back up. I misspoke earlier. It's 108 through 124 are the 300 blackout caliber cartridge cases. But based on my understanding of everything, yeah, there was some type of shooting field or stand that I believe those were collected from, and that kind of seems to coincide with the item descriptions, which is what I'm familiar with.
Okay, and were you aware that when you're sitting in the shooting house and you're doing target practicing, that there was a earthen berm that the shots were fired into?
No, sir, I've never seen this area.
Okay. Would it have been helpful to your analysis if the investigators had dug out items from that earthen berm of the projectiles, such as what's sitting in front of you as State's Exhibit 250?
We're able to look at bullets that are submitted. We don't have any type of restraint. It may have been helpful. Bullets, as we've seen here, come to us in all shapes and sizes due to their damage that they may have sustained. So I'm unable to really answer that question without seeing the evidence and determining if it would be helpful.
Okay. I want to ask you a little more about the conclusions that you've reached as documented in your report, and I'm particularly focused on item 128. And I'm still talking about the Buster 300 blackout that's laying on the floor here in the courtroom. And just so we're clear, there were items, the cartridges that we talked about, the back end of the bullet, that you were able to conclude that they were fired. They were fired by this gun, right?
Yes, sir. I was able to determine, in looking at the totality of the marks on those cartridge cases, that there were items submitted to me have been fired by that firearm.
And your conclusion that they've been fired by this gun, and we're talking about the cartridges. One is cartridge 38, which is up by the residence, correct?
Yes, sir. Sled item 38, that's my understanding, and it was submitted as being recovered from near a door.
Well, and that's the door that you testified that you saw when you went on the property?
Yes, sir, I believe so. That's my understanding.
Okay. And so, it's been a long week, 2 weeks, but there was a sled agent early in the case who had body cams going around picking up spent shell cartridges adjacent to that door, and you believe this is one of those, correct?
That's my understanding, that those items came from the area outside that gun room door.
And you concluded that item 38, along with some other items found at the shooting house, which would be, well, 109 and 110, you concluded. Where 109 and 110 found? Yeah, that's the shooting range, correct?
Yes, sir. As submitted to the lab, collected item 109 was collected from right front corner near field, and item 110 was in front of shooter's chair under table near field.
Okay. And so, one spent cartridge found next to the door up at the main residence at Moselle, and then you've got five found at the shooting range that you say, in your opinion, were fired by this gun.
Yes, sir, that is my opinion.
But then you've also matched other cartridges. According to your report, items 111, 114, 115, 18, 19, 123, and it says 128 in your report, that you say were loaded into, extracted, and ejected from this rifle.
That's correct.
But you don't say they were fired from this rifle.
That's correct.
But they were spent shell casings found at the shooting range, correct?
Yes, sir. And those were fired cartridge cases in its just plain term. They had been fired. When I'm looking at the totality of all these markings, again, we go back to those five areas that we're really going to look at. The marks that I saw that were in agreement that I made that conclusion and based my opinion on were those ejector or lug and extractor marks, and that's not what detonated that primer. So that's the difference there. So we know those marks can occur when that cartridge or fire cartridge case is cycling through there, but that's not what detonated that cartridge, and that's the difference in that result. Yes, sir.
Well, let's look at it from the other side of the coin. So you're saying that the breech marks on the primer, where the firing pin hit the primer, did not match up items, rifle 33, the breech marks on the firing pin didn't match up on these spent cartridges, 111, 114, 15, 118, 119, 123, 128.
No, sir. When I did compare all of these cartridge cases to each other and with those test cartridge cases fired from it, those items, 111, 114, 115, 118, 119, 123, and 128, due to insufficient corresponding markings on that primer and in those breech face marks, I was unable to determine if they were all fired by item 33 or by another firearm or firearms with similar characteristics. I did examine those, and the results of those comparisons were inconclusive.
So you're saying you're not telling the jury they don't match, it's just you couldn't match them. They're inconclusive.
My results of those comparisons were inconclusive, yes, sir.
Okay. And then you also in your report reached the same, you conclude that it's inconclusive on whether item 33, States Exhibit 88, are you saying it's inconclusive whether item 33, Exhibit 88, fired 2 through 7?
That's correct.
Are you saying it's inconclusive as to whether item 33, which is Exhibit States 88, at some point in time, loaded and ejected, extracted from item 33?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Well, we just talked about there's a difference between firing and then cycling and extracting.
Yes, sir.
Tool marks.
Yes, sir.
Did you look at States Exhibit 88 to see if the extraction marks matched up to items 2 through 7?
Based on the evidence that I received, I was able to determine that items 2 through 7 had those matching mechanism marks with items 35 through 37, 39, 108, 113, 116 through 117, and 122, to conclude that those items have been loaded into, extracted and ejected.
Sorry about that.
From the same firearm at some previous time.
But you can't identify the firearm, the gun.
Correct. In terms of being fired by, I was able to determine that several items have been fired by that rifle, and the results of those comparisons with the other items, slid items 2 through 7, 35 through 37, 39, 108, 111 through 120, 122 through 124, and 128. Those comparisons with each other and those test cartridge cases fired by the item 33 rifle were inconclusive.
And so, let's see if I can understand what you're talking about with regard to your conclusions on that items 2 through 7, which were shell casings found near Maggie's body, and other spent cartridges found around the Moselle house and at the shooting range, you conclude that They were loaded into, extracted, and ejected from the same firearm at some previous time.
That's correct.
And for those, I guess we have the same issue. You looked at the primer, the breech marks on the primer, and you couldn't make any conclusions on those, right?
When I looked at the primer area where those breech face and firing pin impressions are, the results of including that in a fire by result were inconclusive. And that is the results for items 2 through 7, and 35 through 37, 39, 108, 111 through 120, 122 through 124, and 128.
And again, aren't the breech marks in the firing pin, aren't those more reliable than extractor marks when you're doing an analysis?
During the marking of these specimens, if you will, through firing, the machining process to create those firearms, we see tool marks on fire cartridge cases and fire bullets from multiple different processes. I can't say that one's more reliable to mark than the other. It's all due to the machining process and also due to the individual wear and tear of that firearm through use of it in repetitive use or abuse of the firearm. That can also add to the markings in each of those locations that we're looking at, whether it be something from the breech face, from the firing pin, those extractors and ejectors, or even the rifling in the barrel. All of those variables can play into those markings and how we see those and how they reproduce on our evidence and how individual they are to each gun.
Well, that does bring me to another point. Isn't your opinion based upon conclusion that every 300 blackout manufactured in the world, whether it's put together by John Bedingfield or mass assembled at Palmetto State Armory or anywhere in the world, that each one, when they cycle a bullet through and eject it, will produce its own unique, like no other in the world, its own unique tool mark? Isn't that what your opinion is based on?
Again, during the manufacturing of these components.
Is that a yes or no?
I would like to explain it a little more.
Your Honor, can I get a yes or no and then an explanation?
Your Honor, I'm objecting. You can answer the question.
Restate the question.
Isn't your opinion based upon the presumption or the basis of your opinion is that every 300 blackout manufactured in the world produces its own unique set of tool marks when it cycles a bullet through? Yes or no?
I would like to answer that with a little bit of explanation if possible.
Your Honor, I would appreciate a yes or no, and he can explain all day long.
If you can answer yes or no, you must answer yes or no, then explain.
Can you repeat the question one more time? I apologize.
Is it your opinion, in this case, about the shell cartridges being fired from the same 300 blackout, isn't that based upon your presumption that each 300 blackout manufacturer in the world makes unique tool marks when it cycles a bullet and ejects it?
It's hard to say. I have not looked at every 300 blackout that's in the world, so it's hard to answer that question. But again, based on my knowledge of that process and how they're made, I'm able to support my answer without answering it in a yes or no manner, I suppose.
But you're saying you found shells here, shells, cartridges here, cartridges there, cartridges at the murder scene. And they all have not all the marks are identical, but enough marks are close enough to being identical. In your opinion, they were fired by one weapon in the world.
It's my opinion that those had all been cycled through the same firearm at one point in time. Yes, sir.
But not fired by the same firearm.
No, sir. That's not what my conclusions say. As far as being fired by that firearm or by the same gun, those results are inconclusive.
So that means that the markings on the breech, because they were all fired, they all have a fire pin hitting the primer, and you call that breech markings, correct?
Yes, sir. Those are breech face markings that we would see on the primer.
And there were dissimilar, dissimilarities between those where you couldn't reach a conclusion.
That's correct. Those shared, again, those same class characteristics. So we compared those to each other. Based on our comparisons, that's correct. There were not enough, there's not enough agreement. There was insufficient agreement there for me to reach a conclusion based on my training and experience and looking at all of these cartridge cases that I could say that they were fired by the same firearm, and that's how we arrived at that conclusion.
And can you say when those tool markings were made on the, or when the, scratch that. Is there any way to determine, for you to determine, when the shell casings, cartridges, were cycled and ejected in this one firearm that's unique to all others in the world?
I cannot date when those were fired or when those were loaded into, extracted, and ejected from a firearm. No, sir. I cannot put a time stamp, if you will, on that. No, sir.
And you can't state whether it was a 300 blackout assembled in 2016, given a for Christmas gift, or if it was a replacement given in 2017 or 2018. I mean, you don't know what year the gun was that cycled and ejected?
That's correct. I do not have knowledge on the year of manufacture of these firearms.
Okay. Now let's move on to the shotguns. And you were, clear a few things up. You were shown a lot of items that were taken, unfired shot shells. And this is 12 gauge. I'm gonna show you exhibit 143, 144, 145, 6, 7, 8. All the way to 50, and I'm not going to ask you to take these out, but I want you to take a look at all those and tell me when those were seized or taken in the evidence in this case.
I do see a date on the packaging. Some of these packages are ripped right through it. That states 9/13/21.
Okay. And so you understand that is June, July, 3 months after these murders, correct?
Yes, sir. That September 13th would be several months after the murders, yes, sir.
And that those were seized at different places around the property?
Yes, sir. According to the information here, it appears they were from different locations and where they were collected from, yes, sir.
Okay. And I guess you don't know whether, I mean, the property at Mazelle was open to Alec Murdoch, I mean, from June till September, as far as you know, right?
I have no knowledge of that, no, sir.
And if he had the mind to, he could go out and remove every shotgun shell on the whole property, right?
I have no knowledge of how the scene was maintained.
Right. Well, it would appear that no one removed any shotgun shells since you have them there in your lap, right?
It does appear that these were collected from these areas listed on the package on September 13 as it's dated and labeled by the person who collected these.
Okay. Let me show you. Exhibit 63 and 60, what I marked is exhibit 63 and 64. And these are pages 51 and 55 from your report. And will you just confirm this for me? 63, 64, pages 51 and 55 from your report.
Yes, sir, I do recognize Defendant's Exhibit 63 appears to be a copy of an Item 10 worksheet for the fired shot shell. And Defendant's Exhibit 64 appears to be a copy of my worksheet for Sled Item 14, which were 24 birdshot pellets.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to introduce into evidence Defendant 63 and 64 in this time. Doug, if you'll pull up 63, which is page 51 of the report, and Agent Greer, will you tell the jury what this is?
Yes, this is just a copy of one of our standard worksheets that we use to document evidence in the laboratory. So this is an ammunition and cartridge case worksheet, which is why I utilized it when I was documenting the Item 10 fired shot shell. And this contains my notes that I took on that item.
Okay, and just so that we're clear, are we talking about Exhibit 33? This is the black colored shot shell that was found in the feed room where Paul Murdoch was murdered?
Yes, sir, that is correct. State Exhibit 33 is the item we're discussing.
And you have a name under notes. It says on shot shell, says, quote, dry lock 3-inch 2. You see that?
Yes, sir, I do.
You see that, Doug? Can you highlight that? Thank you. And again, the exhibit there, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And number two is the size of the pellet?
Yes, sir, that would refer to the size of the pellets or birdshot that was, that we would believe to have been loaded into that cartridge, or that shot shell, excuse me.
Okay. And then if you'll go to exhibit 64, page 55, Doug, and it's 55 in your report, Agent Greer. And are these the pellets that were provided to you to analyze the number two size pellets?
Yes, sir. Sled item 14, I determined to be 24 birdshot pellets, and those were listed as being from dog food storage room.
Okay. And if you'll look at under the caliber, it says number two, and it says steel. These were steel pellets, were they not?
Based on my examination, based on my observation, Yes, sir. They were magnetic, so that would provide that they had some steel in them. Yes, sir.
And birdshot can either be steel or lead, I suspect. Maybe there's a third kind.
There can be multiple different metals used in making pellets. Lead is one, steel is one. There are also other metals that can be used in making pellets, yes, sir.
Have you analyzed any of the Winchester dry locks that were seized in September of 2021 to see whether they're steel or lead?
No, sir, I have not analyzed their contents.
Okay. Now, here you've got Exhibit 64. You've got grain weight. And why don't you explain what you're referring to? I guess I needed, I'm missing a page for that. So if you'll look at your page 54 in your file, because it says continued from Wade, and I guess that's on page 54, is that right?
No, sir, that's just referencing from the weight category that's kind of at the top portion of the page.
Okay.
I just continued my thoughts down below.
Well, so help me out here. You say there's five pellets weighed 3.4 grams, and then 18 pellets only weighed 3.6 grams. How does that work?
I weighed each of those pellets individually. And again, we're weighing in grains. And when I weighed those on our scale, that is what I documented. Five of them weighed 3.4, and that should be a piece. 18 of them each weighed 3.6 grains, and one pellet weighed 3.8 grains.
Okay.
So the total of them all together was approximately 86.4 grains.
Great. Thank you for explaining that. You also weighed the grains of the 300 blackout projectiles. You don't have that in front of us right here, but did you not weigh the grains there?
Yes, sir, I did.
And if you got it, just tell us what they were. I have my notes here. I believe you said 147 grains. State's Exhibit 50, which is your item 8 on your report.
Yes, sir. When I weighed sled item 8, which was one fired bullet, it was approximately 147.4 grains.
And are you familiar with how 300 blackout ammunition is sold, what weight classes there are?
I don't know all of the weight, different weights that are within that caliber, no, sir.
Do you know there's like a subsonic and then supersonic?
Again, I don't know everything about that caliber. There are various weights that bullets are sold in for each caliber, so I would not be surprised at other grain weights, but I don't know all of them off the top of my head today.
So, as far as you know, the only weight you could ever get is 147 grains, right?
When I weighed these items, item 8 and item 12, they weighed approximately 147.
You mentioned in your testimony that item 32, which is Exhibit 91, had a Winchester and a Federal 12-gauge shotgun shells in here. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir, they did have two unfired 12-gauge shot shells submitted with it. That's correct.
But you did more than that when you testified shortly ago. You said one was a Winchester and one was a Federal, I believe.
Yes, sir. One is a Federal premium heavyweight TSS, and one is a 12-gauge Winchester Longbeard XR, I believe.
Okay. The The Winchester is not a dry lock, correct?
No, sir. The markings on that shell said a Longbeard XR.
Nope. And the Winchester found the murder scene is a dry lock, correct?
The item is 10 shot shell, which was recovered from marker 10, which I do believe, my understanding is around the body of Margaret Murdoch, was a Winchester 12 gauge shell, and it says dry lock on it. Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. And then item 22, which is the gun that Alec Murdoch came down, was holding or was leaning up against his Suburban when Deputy Daniel Green arrived. That was, if you understand, loaded with a 12 gauge and a 16 gauge shell, correct?
When I received it, it was unloaded, but I did receive a 12 gauge shell and a 16 gauge shell, that's correct.
And if you fire a 16 gauge shell and a 12 gauge shotgun, what's likely to happen?
That's something that I have not done, so I'm unable to answer that question.
Is it dangerous to do such a thing?
As a firearms examiner, I would recommend shooting the ammo that your firearm is chambered for. I can't predict what would happen if you shot that shot shell or attempted to.
All right. You spoke of this review process at SLED with regard to your tool mark analysis, and you said you do your analysis, you look at things under a microscope, and you type up a report?
Yes, sir. I look at the evidence, reach a conclusion, and write or type those conclusions, yes, sir.
And then a reviewer, someone, and in this case, what was the name? Initial CW?
The reviewer was Chad Smith, another examiner within our department.
Is he on the same level with you at SLED?
He is also an examiner. I don't know his classification, but he has been employed in the department longer than I have completing firearms examination.
Okay. And then he looks at it, but does he prepare an independent report and then flips the two over and see if they match, or does he just take a look at it, come up with his thoughts, and then look at your document to see if he agrees with it?
He does not prepare an independent report. No, he does look at the evidence and arrive at those conclusions, and he would read my results. If he agrees with them, then he will sign off on those conclusions. If he disagrees with them, then there's also a procedure for that to happen.
Now, you mentioned that in order to make an identification or a match, or do you have to have a certain number of similar, or is it similar or identical characteristics?
In order to make an identification, we want to see sufficient agreement between the individual characteristics. There's not a certain number that I use, as we use a method called pattern matching. And we're looking at, under the microscope, all these tiny striations and impressions, and looking at the surface contours of those two tool marks with each other. And we're looking at those individual peaks and ridges and comparing those under high magnification in order to make an identification. And based on that, through our training and experience at doing this job, we look at thousands of comparisons, conduct thousands of comparisons. During that time, we look at things that match each other that we know have been fired from the same gun or made by the same tool, and we look at things that have been fired by separate guns and see if there's any agreement or disagreement. And we look at thousands of these cartridge cases and bullets and tool marks in order to learn what that sufficient agreement is to make our identification.
Okay, and you you gave this jury an analogy like a ladder, and that you have to get up so many steps as you reach. The first step, I guess, would be rifle or shotgun, right? And then the second step would be caliber of rifle, if we're talking about a rifle, and then you keep going up the ladder.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're going to look at those class characteristics. So we're going to determine if, you know, one, if they're the same caliber. Do they share the same rifling specifications if they're a fired bullet? If they are, then we can compare those. If, for instance, if a bullet has five lands and groove and it's going to the right, and we compare that to another bullet that has six lands and grooves and it's going to the left, then we know those did not come out the same barrel, so there's no need to do any type of comparison there. However, if we look at two that have those same lands and grooves, those five lands and grooves, and they're all going to the right, they're the same caliber, then we'll go up that ladder, if you will, and compare those individual characteristics to see if they were fired by the same firearm or not.
Tell this jury how many steps of that ladder you have to go up before you can make an identification.
As far as making an identification, it's based on the marks that what we see under the microscope. When we're looking at all of these marks, we want to see that sufficient agreement. Again, we want to see enough agreement so that what is there is better than anything, any agreement that we've seen in tool marks that have been created by different tools. And that's learned on the job, doing this, doing practicals that I did in training, looking at thousands of comparisons of things that I've test fired, that I know are fired from the same gun, looking at things that I've test fired from different guns and looking at that. It's also done through studies that I participated in training. I'm looking at things that help us know what that sufficient agreement is within all of those features and looking at the totality of those markings. So we're not going to base our opinion just on one little mark. We're going to look at the entire surface area of that bullet, the entire surface area of that cartridge case, in order to make our conclusion. We're not looking at one little mark and making an identification. So we have to think of the totality of all the markings that we see under the microscope.
So the short answer to my question, there is no set number of steps on the ladder you have to reach before you can make your decision.
We use a method of pattern matching again, and that's how we do it. And that's a widely accepted method throughout all firearms examiners in the United States and the world, really. That's what we've been using for years to complete firearms identification, and that's what's been widely accepted, looking at these patterns and comparing them in order to make our identification and reach our conclusion.
Well, now you say it's been widely accepted, but isn't it true that that your field of expertise has become under criticism by the scientific community?
There has been criticism, but again, there's been research completed to support firearms identification, if you will.
Well, I mean, the National Academy of Scientists issued a report and was pretty critical of the objectivity of your work, that it is more subjective because you don't have a set number of rings on a ladder you got to reach. It's based upon your experience, your training, and your opinion. But there's no objective criteria by which to measure whether something matches or not. You're aware of that criticism by the National Academy of Scientists, right?
I'm aware of some of the criticism, yes, sir. However, the process of making the identification is subjective in nature, but it's based on some objective data that we're looking at. There's, again, lots of information that we're looking at, the contours of those tool marks, the individual peaks and ridges of those tool marks, and looking at it, it's not just looking to see is this a match and it looks good. We're really looking in under high magnification at all of these features to see what agreement or disagreement that we can determine. And again, that's based on some objectivity, you know, of how we arrived to that situation.
But you agree that your chosen field is part art as much as science, right?
Our field is an applied science, really. We do use lighting and angles to look at these features under the microscope, and it's important to know how to move those items around and move those lighting and those different stages on our microscope in order to see some of these markings. It can be difficult to do, and there is a special technique that you have to learn in looking at this and doing it and using that microscope to really become familiar and efficient.
Did you agree with me previously in this courtroom under oath that this profession you're in is part art?
There is some art to it, and that's just the lighting thing. For example, we have to look at that, and we have to use that oblique lighting in order to make some of those striations show up. Again, these are tiny little marks that we're looking at, under magnification. But the field itself is not art. It's an applied science. We're using scientific processes to reach these conclusions with years of research to support it.
You first examine item 22 back in June of 2021, correct? Which is the rifle, the shotgun that Alec Murdoch had that was taken by Deputy Green, right?
Yes, sir. Item 22 was a Benelli Model Super Black Eagle, and I did receive that item in June, yes, sir.
And when did you receive? I'm not going to pick it up again, but I dropped it, and it's almost past 5 o'clock on a Friday. I don't want to create more of a delay. But when did you receive the 300 blackout?
Is that the item 33 rifle?
Yes, sir.
You're referring to. I received item 33, which was inside sled container K, on June 10th.
And when did you issue your preliminary opinions on item 33 and item 22 to your agency, SLED?
I released some results to our agents and investigators on June 10th. Yes, sir.
Are you aware after June 10th that sled dive teams have been going out in Colleton County, diving the waters, trying to find murder weapons?
I'm not aware of what all our dive teams were doing. No, sir.
Well, you certainly didn't report to the folks who were relying on your work that we found the murder weapons, did you?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
You didn't report to the folks at SLED who rely upon your analysis that, hey, Eureka, we got the murder weapons.
No, sir, that's not what I reported.
Okay. And you've never received any projectiles from the shooting range at Moselle to compare?
Objection, Your Honor, ask and answer.
I haven't asked my question yet. Have you ever received any projectiles from the shooting range at Moselle to compare to the projectile item number 8?
Object. It's been asked and answered.
Possibly, but you can answer it
again.
Yes, sir.
If you've answered it before.
Based on my understanding of the scene, I do not believe I received any projectiles from that shooting area. But that's based on my understanding of where I believe the other projectiles were recovered from.
When you got item 22, the shotgun, do you know whether it had been swabbed on the inside of the barrel?
I believe it had been processed by other departments. However, I do not know what those swabs entailed.
If a shotgun has been recently fired, does it leave evidence in the barrel that soot and stuff?
Yes, sir. It's possible that we would see some type of residue from firing in that barrel.
And are you aware that Agent Worley swabbed the top before she removed the 16-gauge shell from it?
No, sir. I do not know what Agent Worley did in this investigation.
Can you see residue with the naked eye of a shotgun that had just recently been fired?
Sometimes, yes, sir. And that is something that we also document as part of our examination of the firearm. And when I looked into the barrel and looked down the bore of the item 22 shotgun, I do have in my case file circled that I noticed some fouling or residue in the barrel.
Was it recent fouling or residue, or was it just a dirty gun?
I can't date when that fouling was placed there. That residue was placed there. No, sir, I can't put a time on that.
What about the 300 blackout? Was it? I think you have a note that some fouling there, but maybe I'm confusing it.
Yes, sir, that's correct. On the item 33 rifle, I did note that there was some fouling or residues in that barrel.
The opinion that you have provided this court as to the shell casings from the murder scene, which are items, SLED items 2 through 7, and that your opinion is that they were loaded into, extracted and ejected from the same firearm at some previous time with items 35 through 37, 39, 108, 113, 116, 17, and 122, and those are shell casings that were found around the house and at the shooting range. Your opinion that they were loaded into, extracted, and ejected from the same firearm. Do you hold that opinion with 100% certainty?
Yes, sir. That is my opinion. That is the conclusion that I reached.
Did you ever tell Agent Owen that you could not forensically state with 100% certainty?
No, sir. When I arrived at that conclusion, that was my conclusion. And it was also agreed upon by the reviewing examiner.
So if there's a note in Agent Owen's report that you couldn't reach it with 100% certainty, then someone has made a mistake?
I don't know the contents of Agent Owen's report.
Okay.
Mr. Greer, I'm handing you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 400. Could you kindly review that very, very quickly and let me know if you're familiar with what it is?
Yes, sir.
What is it?
This appears to be a copy of my report.
It's an accurate, complete copy of your report?
Yes, sir, it does appear to be.
All the things we just discussed today?
Yes, sir.
Okay. State would move to admit item four, State's Exhibit 400, I believe it got it.
Okay.
Mr. Greer, please, you know, because some of the questions concerned your field, please tell us how long has firearms identification and tool mark identification, how long has it been around?
In its current form, I would say the early 1900s is when this really became popular, and firearms identification was born with several important cases. It was as early as the 1900s that they started looking at this evidence and looking at those individual characteristics through microscopy. So ever since that time, it's just evolved and grew with further research and support, advances in technology. But it's been around for several years.
And are you familiar with any studies that were done utilizing what would be called consecutive barrels?
Yes, sir.
Firearms? Explain to us what a consecutive barrel study would be and what's done in those.
Sure. When we're looking at those characteristics under the microscope that were imparted onto a fired bullet or a cartridge case, and we're looking at all those tiny little features. A consecutively manufactured study takes into the account of the manufacturing process. So all those marks that we discussed are coming from that gun being produced by a manufacturer. Metal scraping and removing metal. So we have tools cutting and tool stamping and really working on hard metal surfaces. So when we look at a study that has consecutively manufactured things, that presents an opportunity for a worst case scenario for us as examiners. If those tools were going to leave markings on other firearms, so if you had this breech face being made by the tool and it made the next one, it made the next one, those are consecutively manufactured. If there's any carryover of those characteristics from one to another, that's what that study does. It highlights that and it puts that as an emphasis as part of that study. And we as examiners are looking at that, that's our worst case scenario. If we're going to see any carryover of that tool making that item or that breech face, we would expect to see marks. There's several studies that are out there, and I've participated in several of those as part of my training, where we're given samples that have been fired by consecutively manufactured barrels. So if we see any agreement between each of those barrels, we should see it there. Or studies where we have consecutively manufactured breech faces. Again, those are breech faces made by the same tool, one right after another. And if we see agreement in there, we should see it in that study. I've participated in those studies, those research projects. Some of them have been studies prior to me becoming an examiner, and I was able to clearly distinguish and accurately distinguish between those projectiles. So I was able to determine those projectiles were fired by this barrel, and this barrel, or that cartridge case was fired by this gun with that breech face, this gun with that breech face, and this gun with that breech face. So we are aware of that in our community, and we do things to be proactive on that, and that's just an example. And that's something I participated in and was able to successfully pass as part of my competency in determining what was fired by what in those consecutively manufactured studies.
And you were able to compare firearms that you know were consecutively manufactured one after the other, right after the other.
That is correct.
And just for clarity, we're talking about, I'm referring to items 33 and 22 on your report. That would be the item 33 being the blackout rifle, and then item 22 on the camouflage Super Black Eagle 3.
Yes, sir.
Your results for some of those were, when you say inconclusive, that what does that mean? Does that mean that they could have been fired, or that they you just can't determine?
That's correct. Inconclusive is one of our conclusions that we can issue when there's not enough agreement or disagreement there in those tiny microscopic characteristics. So what inconclusive means is it's possible it could have been fired by that gun, and it's possible that it may not have been fired by that gun.
Attention to states, to your item number 165, states exhibit 147. Remind us again what that item is.
Could I see item 165?
You make me find it.
Sorry.
It's fine. Find it in your report if you have it.
No, sir. I'm not sure that I'll be able to find it.
Yes, should be here. Unfortunately. 146. All right. I'm handing you what's. I entered into evidence of states 147. That would be sled item 165.
Yes, sir.
Did you identify what it is again and where it was located when it was found, more importantly?
Yes, sir. This was a Winchester 12-gauge shot shell. And on the side of the shot shell, it's stamped dry lock 3-inch 2. On the packaging for states exhibit 147, it says from nightstand in Paul's room.
Now, I know counsel asked you a question about, you know, your field being an applied science. Just so we understand what an applied science is, are there any other examples of fields that are applied in that general realm of applied sciences?
Yes, sir. A lot of what we do as firearms examiner is learned through our process of training and looking at samples and learning the job. It's kind of like, if you will, a physician. They go to school. They learn a lot in their medical school, but they still do a residency program, if you will. So they're on the job, doing on-the-job training.
Your Honor, object. Comparing his, what he does to...
Objection, overruled. Right. Continue.
Please continue.
Yes, sir. So they learn things in school. Firearms identification is not something that you can necessarily go to a school and learn to do. You can't get a four-year degree and become a firearms examiner the next day. There are universities across the nation that have firearms identification as part of their firearms program, and they're teaching that component. But in order to achieve your competency at this, you need the on-the-job training. You need the experience and looking at these samples and knowing how to evaluate the markings that we're looking at on these ammunition components.
Lastly, Agent Greer, Mr. Greer, I'm going to refer you to State's Exhibit 400. I'm going to put that on the screen. I'm going to direct your attention to item 128. Can you see that on your screen, Mr. Greer?
Yes, sir, I can.
Specifically, your findings concerning 2 through 7. You see where my pen's pointing?
Yes, sir, I do.
Which items were 2 through 7?
Those were from markers 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, respectively. And from my understanding of the crime scene, those were the ones that were located around Margaret Murdoch's body.
Okay. And again, we're on what page now, Mr. Greer?
That's on page 7, yes, sir.
Items 2 through 7 found around Maggie's body. Items 35 through 37 and 39, where were those located?
Those were from the side entrance door, which would be the door, I believe, coming out of the gun room area.
And items 108, 113, 116 through 17, and 122, where were those located?
Those were from various areas thought to be from the shoot field or from the field.
And tell me again what your conclusion was.
I was able to determine that based on matching characteristics in the mechanism marks, that items 2 through 7, 35 through 37, 39, 108, 113, 116 through 117, and 122 had all been loaded into, extracted, and ejected from the same firearm at some previous time.
Nothing further.
Thank you. Further examination.
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. You may step down. And while he's preparing to step down, ladies and gentlemen, we will recess for the remainder of the day and the weekend, and we'll need you back at 11:30 on Monday morning, 11:30. Please do not discuss the case. Which witnesses will you have?
Your Honor, if we're talking about the in-camera hearing, we'll have Mark Tinsley. And we do have another issue, which I believe I had indicated to Your Honor, perhaps in a pretrial conversation, as to a conversation that took place a few days after the crimes occurred. In which there were a number of individuals present. Mr. Murdoch was present. I don't know the contents of that meeting because I've been out of an abundance of caution, have stayed away from that, and I believe that we may have a little bit of testimony just on whether or not there is any attorney-client privilege to that conversation. I've been careful throughout this investigation preparation not to be privy to that, but I do believe that it is not an attorney-client privilege conversation, but I'd like the court's ruling on that before I came privy to the contents of that. That's the only other issue at this time that I think would be addressed in camera that morning.
Your Honor, and my
yes,
sort of a surprise here, were those conversations recorded?
No.
and I mentioned this in our pre-trial.
Yeah, I just didn't know what you're referring to. Neither one of us know what the contents of those conversations are.
I believe Mr. Griffin was present at this meeting, which is exactly why I wanted the court's ruling before I became privy to the contents of the defendant's statements at that meeting.
No, we're not quite sure, but we'll wait with bated breath to hear whatever it is.
Can you be more specific as to what you're talking about, Mr. Waters?
From my understanding, there was a meeting or some sort of gathering in which Mr. Griffin and Mr. Murdoch and then a number of other individuals were present, in which the defendant made some statements. The contents.
Individuals?
No, no. I think some of his partners and other individuals, maybe some family, to which I have never been privy to the contents. However, I would like to know the contents, but I've been careful out of an abundance of caution not to ever become privy until I had a ruling from the court that there was no attorney-client privilege because of the presence of third parties to that conversation. So I would like to address that with the court, and if the court believes that and rules that there is no attorney-client privilege, then I may, you know, at the appropriate time, examine people who were present at that conversation as to what the defendant said.
And is that in relation to financial crimes or?
No, sir, that would be in relation to the murders of Maggie and Paul. But it is an in-camera matter that if we have the time available, I wanted to raise that with the court. Maybe we can go ahead and knock that one out as well.
All right. Any thoughts by the defense?
Your Honor, what he's referring to is, it was on Thursday, June the 10th, when SLED came to John Marvin Murdoch's hunting property to interview Alec, to interview John Marvin Murdoch, Randy Murdoch, Buster Murdoch, and I was there to represent Alec for purposes of that. Before SLED got there, we were all in the house. I have no idea what beyond that he's talking about. I mean, what was supposedly said or heard, or I have no idea, but beyond that. But I don't know of any conversations that he's trying to find the substance of and who he's going to get them from.
Your Honor, I think that's just it. We would have a witness as to the circumstances of who was present, and in the event that Your Honor rules that because of the presence of third parties, it was not a protected conversation, then I would then, become privy or asked to become privy to the content of that.
By inquiring of who?
Well, the witness who were present, and so I'm going to call one of those, which
the
could
law
be
partners.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, I wouldn't even have to do that on the stand. I would just want Your Honor's blessing before I did that because of an abundance of caution and protection of the attorney-client privilege. At that point, I could, offline become privy to the content of it. It may be nothing. I've just been told that there was that meeting and the circumstances of it, and I don't believe it's protected, and so I'd like to know what the defendant said at that meeting.
Yes, sir.
Sounds like he's asking for a deposition, Your Honor. And he's got no right to an evidentiary hearing about what happened at a meeting in the course of a trial. He's got no right to compel people to come testify so we can find out what was said. That's discovery. I mean, state grand jury allows him to do that, but there's no rule that permits him to conduct a deposition, whether in court or out of court, and that's what he's trying to do.
Not asking to conduct a deposition, Your Honor. I've actually been doing this out of abundance of caution and protection of the defendant's rights and making sure that we didn't cross the line without the court's input. And again, the content may be something that's useful or not.
Well, if you'd like to brief or send a memo or cases to the court regarding statements made in the presence of counsel and third parties, whether that's protected by attorney-client privilege or not, then the court can address the issue.
Yes, sir, Your Honor, and I'll be happy to address that Monday morning. I will. I do have a case, Marshall v. Marshall, 320 Southeastern 2nd 44, which just generally, of course, states the rule that if attorney-client privilege communications are related in the presence of third parties, then the protection is lost. I can go ahead and hand that one up to Your Honor, and I certainly be prepared to address that in any greater detail.
Anything further?
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
Nothing from defense, Your Honor.
Right, we'll be in recess till 9:30.
All right.
And that wraps up our sixth segment of coverage for you today in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our updates, commentary, and courtroom coverage as we bring it to you right here. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Hey guys, it's Erin Andrews from Calm Down with Erin and Carissa. They say you can't plan for the unexpected, but they probably haven't heard of Aflac. You know them as the famous duck, but Aflac is a leader in supplemental insurance. They can better prepare you for life's surprises by helping cover expenses your health insurance doesn't. Even with good health insurance, medical bills are no joke. Many people don't realize health insurance wasn't designed to cover everything, which means money set aside for essentials like rent goes towards unexpected medical bills instead. That's where Aflac comes in. They pay cash that can be used for anything you choose. Think copays, deductibles, and even non-medical expenses like gas or groceries. Without Aflac, if you're sick or injured, gaps in your coverage can come back to haunt you. With Aflac, you can better protect yourself against the unexpected and help provide you and your family with financial security and added peace of mind. You can't predict the future, but you can better prepare for it with Aflac. Get help with expenses health insurance doesn't cover. Visit Aflac.com to learn more.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabe Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out WashableSofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabe sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
L-E-D-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.